Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, boating safety. Starting this year, if you're born after 1978, all boaters in New York must have a boating certificate. We'll tell you what you need to know to get certified. Herbal medicines in the colonial era. As early settlers began to colonize the shores of America, herbs were among the most important cargo. Herbs for healing, herbs to improve the flavor of a very bland diet, and herbs to distinguish the smells that were part of poor sanitation and spoilage. We chat with herbalist Richard Mandelbaum about why herbs were so vital in colonial America and what we can learn about their use today. Plus, a free outdoor concert in Wayne County, movie night in Wayne County, pardon me, and a traditional storytelling festival in West Fulton, New York. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Jury deliberations in the criminal hush money trial of former President Donald Trump are set to resume at this hour in New York City. After a month of testimony, jurors are weighing the evidence presented during the trial from both the prosecution and the defense. NPR's Domenico Montanaro explains what the outcome of the case might mean for voters.
The overwhelming sentiment among respondents was that a guilty verdict would not make any difference. Two-thirds said that it would make no difference. Another 15%, mostly Republicans, said a guilty verdict would make them more likely to vote for him in the latest NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. But I will say, former president found guilty is not a headline Trump wants.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro reporting. Trump is accused of falsifying business records related to payments made to an adult film star ahead of the 2016 election. The former president has repeatedly denied all charges. Negotiations are expected today at the United Nations on a Security Council resolution drafted by Algeria that demands an immediate end to Israel's military operation in the city of Rafah. Linda Vasulo reports the United States says the proposed resolution is not balanced.
U.S. Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood told reporters Wednesday that approving another U.N. Security Council resolution is not necessarily going to alter the situation on the ground in Gaza. The Algerian draft demands that Israel immediately halt its military offensive in Rafah, and it demands an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, as well as the release of all hostages by Hamas. The U.S. has vetoed several council resolutions demanding an immediate ceasefire, but abstained on a measure allowing a temporary truce during Ramadan. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
Stocks on Wall Street opened lower this morning as we learned the U.S. economy grew more slowly in the first 3 months of the year than initially reported. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by 381 points in early trading.
Revised figures from the Commerce Department show the nation's gross domestic product grew at an annual rate of 1.3% in the first quarter, down from 1.6% in the original estimate. Most of that downshift reflects lower consumer spending. The Federal Reserve's Beige Book also reports that a growing number of cost-conscious shoppers are pushing back against higher prices. More stores are offering discounts to get customers in the door. The hunt for bargains has been good for some retailers. Dollar General reported better-than-expected quarterly profits today. Both Dollar General and Dollar Tree have seen double-digit increases in customer traffic. Stock in Kohl's department stores tumbled, though, after an unexpected quarterly loss. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. It appears Mexico is on the verge of electing its first female president. Claudia Sheinbaum, the former mayor of Mexico City, has emerged as the frontrunner in a landmark election set to be held this weekend. Sheinbaum has a PhD and has shared a Nobel Peace Prize. She also has the strong backing of the Mexican president. The United Kingdom's opposition Labour Party will likely ban one of its most high-profile lawmakers from running in the country's general election. Villa Marx reports the move follows an investigation into remarks she made last year about degrees of racism.
Diane Abbott was the first black female member of Britain's parliament when initially elected in the 1980s and has been a leading left-wing member of Labour ever since. As the party's moved to the centre-left and led national polls in recent years under Keir Starmer, after a massive defeat 5 years ago in the last UK election, radical left-wing voices have been slowly silenced. Amid a roiling public debate about anti-Semitism in Labour last year, Abbott was suspended from the party for writing that Jewish and other minority communities faced prejudice, but not the kind of lifelong racism experienced by people of colour. She says she's upset she might be barred as a party candidate, though Labour's failure to clarify its treatment of her for months has prompted frequent criticism from Conservatives, including top government ministers. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
Parts of northern India are in the midst of a sweltering heat wave. A suburb of the capital, New Delhi, recorded a temperature of 126 degrees on Wednesday, a record high, but that number has yet to be verified. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Disney Plus, with the new Disney Plus original documentary, Jim Henson, Idea Man. Filmmaker Ron Howard captures Henson's artistic evolution in the style and spirit of his complex subject. Streaming May 31st on Disney Plus.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. This weekend's forecast calls for mostly sunny and pleasant conditions with highs in the lows to mid-70s. Perfect weather to get out on the water, especially if you're a boater. But if you were born in 1978 or later, you now need a boating safety certificate in New York State starting this year. Then next year, everyone operating motorized watercraft vessels will need that certificate regardless of age. It's part of the phase-in of requirements of legislation that was passed in 2019. Jason Dole spoke to Alexi Howland, Director of Marine Services and Recreational Vehicles for the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation about what boaters need to know. We'll get to that in just a minute, having a little technical difficulty. And we will get the voting info for you. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. We'll take a quick break and we'll get this fixed. We'll be right back with you.
Inside Russia. First, we take a listen to...
All right, we are back. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. It's live from our studios in Liberty, New York, and we were talking about boating safety and the boating safety certificate that folks born after 1978 will need starting this year. Jason Dole spoke with Alexi Howard from the New York State Parks and Recreation Department.
The requirements to have a boating safety certificate if you're operating a motorized vessel initially started in 2020. And the phase-in period has been rolling across the past 5 years, with the culminating point essentially being January 1st of 2025, all operators of motorized vessels must have a boating safety certificate. So that's the point we're getting to, and that's the point that we're looking forward to, is everyone out there on the water having a safety certificate and being better prepared for the elements.
So that's the timing of the requirement. So what else is inside the law? What do people need to be trained on, I guess?
So there's a few things that they're going to go over in the boating safety course, but the overall goal is just to increase the knowledge and the basic boating skills of the folks out there on the water. Unfortunately, it came following the tragic accident in 2005 with Brianna, who was the 11-year-old girl that unfortunately passed away because of a boating accident. So we're really looking just to increase that knowledge, boating safety skills, as well as learning what safety equipment you need to have on your vessel while you're out there on the water. So increasing the overall knowledge really helps everyone out there extend their courtesies to others out on the water and everyone else having a safer day.
Yeah, and I'll just underline that this law is known as Brianna's Law. And like you said, that fatal boating accident happened in 2005. So here we are almost 20 years later. The full effects of this law are going into effect. What are the sorts of things that boaters need to keep in mind to be safer?
One of the biggest things is keeping an eye on your speed and just your overall attention. I know a lot of boaters that have been boating for quite some time now, decades even, that, you know, are a little bothered by the fact that they have to take the course. But it really is just going to serve as a great refresher, and I guarantee, you know, they'll learn something new if they do approach it with an open mind. So complacency out there is a huge issue, because losing that situational awareness is one of the top contributing factors in accidents out there on the water. I just want to encourage everyone to take the course. I want to encourage everyone to wear a life jacket while they're out on the water. By law, it needs to be readily accessible. However, with how quickly things change in the marine environment, I just want to encourage everyone to just wear it. You know, things happen in an instant, and there's really no telling when things are going to happen out there on the water. So already having that life jacket in place will really go a long way in any type of incident.
As far as the course goes, how much of a course is it? How do people take it?
Of course. So people need to take a state-approved course. They can find those on our website at parks.ny.gov/boating. And they'll be able to see a list of courses, both offered online and in person, and that's hopefully to increase the accessibility of the courses to folks around the state. And those courses are going to be offered by volunteers and paid instructors. So I do encourage everyone to check out the fees associated with each, just so they can make sure they're aware of what those fees are prior to enrolling in the course. However, everyone will have to pay $10 to receive their permanent certificate. So upon completion of the course, they'll get a temporary, and that'll last for 90 days. And then they'll receive a permanent certificate in the mail, and they need to keep that on them while they are boating out on the water.
You're trying to get the word out. There's press releases. We're talking to you as a way to get the word out. Is there information at places where people are buying boats, renting boats? Is there a, like a, is that a front in the information effort?
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to get the word out there every way possible. So we're working with yacht clubs, law enforcement agencies, boat distributors, and we're trying as much as we can to get the word out. We're also running some media campaigns as well, just trying to push the fact that they need to have a boating education course. Because it was a 5-year rollout plan, there's really not a grace period out there on the water. If you fall within the requirements, for example, this year in particular, born on or after January 1, 1978, you need to have that boating safety certificate. Unfortunately, if you don't, there are some consequences to essentially not being compliant with that. These folks can face a fine up to $250, and their voyage could be terminated for the day. So I really just encourage everyone, and this goes into just the comprehensive planning and due diligence when you're purchasing a boat, outfitting your boat with the appropriate equipment, making sure that you have everything you need and you're well prepared to be out there on the water.
So, yeah, so that's the penalties and of what people could face if they don't comply. How is this going to be enforced? How will you know if people aren't certified?
Sure. So we have law enforcement agencies throughout the state that work with marine services and conduct marine law enforcement patrols. So when they go on board vessels out there, they're going to be able to ask for proof of the boating safety certificate, and that's how they'll be checking for compliance. So each year we actually hold trainings for law enforcement agencies throughout the state, and we get them trained and up to speed on all things that are new, changed, laws or regulations that are going on within the state. So they are fully up to speed and aware and know what to look for when they're out there on the water.
Okay. Do you have any other tips for folks about how to be safe in and around the water this season?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest thing is to wear a life jacket. I know folks can think that they're cumbersome and just uncomfortable to wear, but they really have made some great life jackets in recent years that are still Coast Guard approved. So please just make sure they are Coast Guard approved and in good condition. Go ahead and wear that. Another big thing is just to make sure you're telling someone where you're headed and where you'll think they'll be back. I can't tell you how many times folks head out on the water and they ended up being in distress. And the only reason we knew that is because a loved one or a friend called and said, hey, they were supposed to be back a few hours ago and they're not, and I'm worried about them. So telling someone where you're headed and when you think you'll be back can be a lifesaver. And then last but not least, I just want to encourage everyone to boat sober. Operating under the influence is illegal. And with the added stressors in the marine environment, how quickly things can change and how unpredictable it is, any presence of drug or alcohol is just going to have extreme effects on the operator. And it continues to be a leading contributing factor in boat fatalities through New York State. So please just boat sober.
And that also just loops back around to the very first thing you told us and underscores that, that being aware of the situation is crucial if you're going to be out there on the waters, and you can't be aware if you're impaired.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't reiterate that enough.
I can imagine in your position that unfortunately every year you hear some of these worst stories, some of the tragedies that actually occur out there on the water. So it must be front and center for you, right?
It is, absolutely. And it's a shame. But on a positive note, I do want to say that New York State, with the increased education, with more folks wearing life jackets and more folks being prepared out there, we have seen a stark decline in fatalities and injuries out on the water. We all know that one fatality is one too many. But I do want to highlight how New Yorkers are really embracing this change, and they're embracing the water for what it is and respecting for what it is. And we really have seen a decrease in our numbers over the past couple of years. So I do just want to bring that to light.
Wow. So even without the law being fully rolled out, you're already seeing a positive impact. I imagine you're hoping for that trend to continue as we see the full implementation next year, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the goal. I'm honestly surprised that this requirement hasn't been in place, but I'm happy to see that it is. And I'm happy to see, just the safety and the enjoyment out there on the water increasing, because we have beautiful waterways in New York State. I love being out on the water, and, the best way to enjoy it is to enjoy it safely. So the fact that we're doing a great job and in the right direction, I just want to applaud everyone in New York State for really embracing this change and taking it head on and being prepared when they go out there.
We've been talking to Alexi Howland, Director of Marine Services and Recreational Vehicles for the State of New York Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. Alexi, thank you so much for going over all this.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
And there's more information about those boating safety courses, as well as other boating education information, at parks.ny.gov/boating. We'll take a break. And when we come back, free movie night in Wayne County. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Wayne County Employee Social and Wellness Committee and the Wayne County Public Library are presenting a free outdoor movie this Saturday at Wayne County Park near Beach Lake. The committee plans events and activities that promote wellness and community among the county employees. And this time, in conjunction with the library, movie night is open to the entire community free of charge. Joining us now is Mickey Useps, our good friend from Wayne Tomorrow. Good morning, Mickey.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. You were just here last week to tell us about all the great Memorial Day activities that were going on. And now this free movie night. Why did the committee for the employees in the county decide to, open it up to everybody?
Well, we really operate within the community of within the employees, within the Wayne County employee community. But we wanted to kind of stretch it out a little bit, and we had one of our members had said, what about doing a community movie night? And so in order to make all that happen, we had to connect with the Wayne County Public Library, which works out because I'm part of the wellness committee as well as part of the Wayne County Public Library Board. So because they can get the rights to actually show a movie in it for public, which is something that you have to, you know, you have to pay the people that made the movie.
Yeah.
So we partnered with them to be able to do it. The committee paid the licensing fee, and they're helping us to sponsor it.
We should just like make your title Mickey Wayne County USIPs, because you wear a lot of hats and you do a lot of great good there too. We'll get to the movie that you'll be showing in just a second. But what again is the connection with the Wayne County Public Library? Is it just kind of a natural connection because of everybody's involvement there in the county?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the libraries are a place where everybody can go. And, you know, they're an important partner to the county through Wayne Tomorrow, but also in the community. I mean, they just play. We have seven of them all across the county. The one in Honesdale is just one of them. But every one of them is working to make life better and more enjoyable and more interesting for their communities. And it was just a natural partnership because that's the kind of thing we're trying to do within the employee community at the county.
All right. So what movie are you going to be showing for free movie night on Saturday?
Okay. So that's one of the glitches. I can't actually tell you the name of the movie, but what okay. I can tell you is that it is a 2023 film about a rather quirky candy maker that we all know from the beloved Roald Dahl story.
Ah, okay. All right.
All right.
Now, are there licensing issues as to why you can't say it over the airwaves here?
Right. I can talk all about the movie, but I can't say the name.
Gotcha. So, you know, if you're a fan of perhaps chocolate
and a particular character named Willie.
Well, yeah, diminutive candy workers who make particular sounds like Oompa Loompa.
Yeah.
That might be for you. Right. This might be for you.
And it's a great family-oriented musical and delightful, delightful, delightful. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
Now, this is the latest version of this, the one that came out in 2023 that starred Timothy Chalamet. So,
yeah, and he's a wonderful. He pays such a wonderful homage to Gene Wilder, and you know, he's just got this really. It's really wonderful. It's a great movie.
So that's the one
I'm
grew
so
up
glad
on.
You're showing it.
Yeah, I grew up on the Gene Wilder version of it, and so to see this version of it, I was like, oh, I was a little skeptical, but he charmed me. The movie charmed me. It was cute, and it was also good to kind of revisit that chocolate fantasy world.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, in the theme of this movie that shall not be named, are you going to have popcorn and candy available?
We are. We're going to be very inexpensive candy, popcorn, and hot dogs we're going to be serving up. We're also going to have a raffle. So if you buy a raffle ticket, you might win a copy of the movie that we're going to be watching.
Okay.
That we can't name.
That we can't name.
Right.
But it's a world of pure imagination.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Okay. What are the details, the timing of the movie, where and when? I mentioned it's at the park and Beach Lake, but kind of where is that for folks and what time does it start?
Right. So the Wayne County Park is located at 245 Bethel School Road. It's Honesdale technically, but it's actually between Indian Orchard and Beach Lake. And if you know where the Human Resources Center is, it is across the street. We'll have some signs up so you'll be able to find. We've got lots of parking and a big tent, so we won't even have to worry about the dew. The weather's supposed to be beautiful. So we really encourage folks to come out, bring the little ones, and come and enjoy it. We're going to have some activities going on a little bit, not too much. We've got a Roald Dahl character name generator, so you can make up a silly name for yourself. And then we're going to be encouraged, since we're partnered with the library, we're encouraging all the kiddies to make up a story about their character. We're really excited. We're going to have Team Gobstopper and Team Sweet Tart, and lots of fun to be had.
All right. And where can folks get more information about the free movie night to get all those details?
Sure. So if you go to the Wayne County Courthouse Facebook page, we've got an event set up there. You can get all the details there and let us know if you're thinking about coming or coming.
All right. Mickey USIPs. Go ahead.
Admission is admission is totally free of charge.
Oh, great.
You don't need to spend a dime to come and enjoy it.
Okay. Mickey Yusup's from Wayne County. She's on the board of the Wayne County Library with Wayne Tomorrow, helps us out with all kinds of Wayne County news and information, and also keeps a pretty good tight lip on things she can't reveal publicly. Yeah. But
that's
it is a movie based on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So
that is correct.
I think you kind of all get it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody figured it out.
Okay.
And if you didn't stop by, it's going to be a blast anyway.
Yeah. So wait, so the movie's called Hershey, right? That's what it's called. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you go.
All right, Mickey. Thank you so much.
You bet. Have a great day.
Have a good time. All right, that's all for this segment, and then we're going to move on to a storytelling festival. We'll take a break, and we will learn more about this traditional storytelling festival that's taking place in West Fulton this weekend, West Fulton, New York. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi there, this is Brian, host of The Secret Show. Friday nights at 9. I'll be playing a mix of indie, alternative, college, rock, and pop. Some new music and some old classics. That's The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9, only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's new show, Electric Mountain, bringing you a choice selection of dance music from back in the day to today. I'll also feature a guest DJ every week spinning a continuous set, bringing their unique style. Come dance with us each and every Saturday night from midnight to 2 a.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Yeah, let's go.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Juana Summers. We've got your back when it comes to reporting the news. And one of the things this station counts on to keep it all going, contributions.
Including that vehicle you no longer need. Donate it. Help us bring you the news you count on. Learn more by visiting this station's website. And thanks.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A traditional storytelling festival is taking place this weekend in West Fulton, New York. It features the creation stories that have been passed down through generations. And here to tell us more are Liv Big Tree Sky Woman from Forever Farm and Joe T. Ma, a delegate of the Mother Earth delegation of United Original Nations, one of the folks that are putting on the storytelling festival in cooperation with The Fountain and the Center for Sacred Studies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy rising.
Thank you both for joining us. I wanted to let folks know about this traditional storytelling festival, but I want folks to understand, what are traditional storytelling stories that you're talking about? I kind of briefly mentioned it, creation stories that have been passed down through generation. Can you explain to folks who may not be familiar with this, what are creation stories that you're telling?
Yeah, for sure. So, Goli, what you have on you get? Onyata aganiwa gahanjod, wagunyata aniwa gitawod. Hello, everyone. I just introduced myself in my language. My ungwehoi name is Wadyahnalio, which translates to she puts down a good track. I'm Turtle Clan and Oneida, and I've been a part of this rematriation process here in Yoskohole, which is kind of translates to the place of cleaning, but it's also known as Schoharie Valley, New York. So anyways, I live at Yojijizu Forever Farm, Sky Woman's Forever Farm, and I'm just really grateful to be here today alongside Joe T. So as the rematriators of this land and the stewards of this land, we've opened up these lands here to host this beautiful gathering in which elders from many different bloodlines and lineages will come together to share stories. And I think it's safe to say that all of humanity, it's a really great way to connect. Storytelling is a beautiful way of connecting lineages. And so we're here on the land as the rematriators. We opened it up for all these elders to come and share stories from their lineages, their life experiences, in regards to this challenging time that we are living in today. You know, we all face climate change. We're in a time of great change with our planet Earth. And so these elders are here to remind us of the love that we come from. And that's exactly what stories are there to remind us of, is the love that we come from and the love that we represent. That's something a role model and guide of mine kind of taught me. But yeah, anyways, this is Jyoti. She can share a little bit more about Storytelling Festival and the work that she does and what we're here to do this weekend.
Well, I think you said it all in the best way possible, but I just want to answer your question too around, you know, creation stories were given by the Mother Earth to all the original lines around this planet because those stories helped them know how to care for her and what she needed so she could stay in a good way and all life could be sustained for all of us. We got away from that. We broke from it. We're trying to return and heal that so that all of us can remember our connection with this Mother Earth. And we can listen more deeply to what she needs. These stories also carry prophecy, and prophecy that tells us about this moment of time that we're sitting in. And all spiritual paths from all nations carry such instruction. And now the prophecies through the storytelling can also tell us how to walk through these times so we can stay kind with one another. We can return to a way of life that honors all life as sacred. So if you're hearing this, bring your children, bring your families. This is a moment to gather at the fire. They used to say when the storytellers would come, there was somebody always running in front saying, the storytellers are coming, the storytellers are coming. Well, I'm that one running in front saying this because it's a very special moment that you can sit around the fire, that you can sit here in these ceremonial ways, that you can hear these stories come to you through sometimes their language and then into English so everyone can understand. For just like Liv just said, right now we must all nations stand together and listen to this earth, for she needs healing, and we're the ones to help in that way by supporting our original people that carry the formula for that healing. So come and join us around the fire.
Jyoti, when you talk about the Mother Earth story and being part of the Mother Earth delegation, you're carrying out instructions, you say, that Mother Earth has been giving you. Can you explain that to folks who may not understand what that means in terms of how they can understand it, especially during these troubling times that we're in and you refer to?
Thank you. That's a really good question, you know, because the Mother Earth delegation, there was a delegation of about 28 of us from around the planet that had been brought to London to a gathering there. And during the third morning, very early, we got the news that more fires had been started in the Amazon. We see that as the lungs of this planet. So more fires were burning up the way that we could all breathe. And then we heard that 2.5 tons of radioactive water from Fukushima had been poured in the ocean. The ocean is life giving to everything here. Our water lives in us, you know, not just around us. It lives in us. So we have to come back to remembering that. So that day, we were told by spirit that we needed to stand up and declare our solidarity and to return the sacred territories to the original caretakers. So we all heard that call, and we all started to gather, and they asked myself and my sister Loretta Afreda-Bear-Cook, who's a Gwala Sioux, if we would carry this forward. And we have done so, and now the instruction we received, because if you just listen deeply, every one of you has that voice inside that says, oh, don't go up that road today. And when you listen, everything's good. And when you don't listen, then you have a car wreck or something happens. We all receive this instruction, but are we listening? So we're here to say it's time to listen. And what we got three instructions. When we decided we are definitely going to become together as this delegation, we were to go to the north. So we went to the north for the Sami. And we were to call upon the spiritual leaders and the healers from there to come sit at our table. And they did. In fact, we have one of the Sami here with us today that will be a storyteller. And their sacred way of telling story is yorking. And when they york, the earth herself sings through them, and you can feel it touch you. It's so beautiful. These old ways are so beautiful. They help us remember. And then she said, go to the south. So we went to the Yucatan, and you call on those spiritual leaders and healers, and they came to sit at our table. And the third instruction, the final one we got so far, was to come to the east gate here on what we call Turtle Island, North America. Come and knock on the east gate. Now, we don't know what's going to happen when we knock at that east gate, but I've got Liv here and her beautiful family that's going to welcome us into this territory following original principles. There's a way when you come into someone's house that they like to offer you in. Say, yes, please do come in. So we're knocking, saying, and they're going to say, yes, please come in. So when we open tomorrow, that'll be the first thing that people will experience. What is that ceremony that says, yes, you may now come into my house? And this is how my house likes to be run, taken care of. So everybody prospers from this. Everybody gets healed from this. Everybody remembers themselves, again, becomes kind. You know,
yeah.
So this is how spirit works in our lives. And we just follow the instructions. Now I'm here, I'm finishing this third one. I don't know what she's going to tell us is the next part of the story. I'm about to find out.
Yeah. So the gift of storytelling, as you refer to as well, is part of this festival, which features storytellers and musicians and people from all walks of life. It's happening starting tomorrow, as you said, through Sunday at Waterfall House in West Fulton, New York. There are more things involved. I can see the agenda here, and it includes, opening prayer, and it's really a kind of a spiritual gathering for these stories for folks to hear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and it welcomes all ways of prayer because it brings us all back. Every way brings us back to one source.
So there's not really a religious element. It's more of the spiritual element and this connection to the original peoples and the earth.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
One thing I noticed as well is another member of your Mother Earth delegation, grandmother, and I hope I say her name correctly, Luisa Teich, teacher, dancer, storyteller. And one of the quotes that she gave was that we must re-inspirit the art of storytelling. Our children must learn to sit still and listen. The story is important in their instruction, end quote. Can you talk a little bit about why it's so important for children to understand and the art of storytelling? I suppose so that these stories can continue to be passed down through these generations.
Well, right now, you know, we have storytelling everywhere, but, you know, you've really got to look at where a story comes from. And when it has a root, when it has an origin that goes back to the original time, then that's something, you know, knew how to live through all the different stories and changing of stories and forgetting stories and bad stories. And, you know, I remember there was a story one time that I was told that there was this old man that went up the river in the Amazon, and he got off the boat and he saw this old man standing there looking down the river. And he went up to him. He was a psychologist. I wish I could remember the name of this book. I'm sorry. I apologize for that. But he asked the old man. He said, I came down the river, and I see that, you know, there's oil in the river, and there's this and that. And we from the West, we brought this in the wrong way. And the old man said, yes, the world is as you dream it. And the old man, and the man asking him that to come down the boat, that psychologist, he said, yeah, but we made such a nightmare. And the old man said, oh, yeah, you did make a nightmare. But the world is as you dream it. You know, now the psychologist said, but what can we do to wake out of the nightmare? And the old man said, oh, it's very simple. You just take one seed, turn it around and give it to the one standing behind you, and the world is as you dream it. It takes that long. So right now in this storytelling moment, we're trying to turn around and give that seed, that original seed of what story from the earth teaches us. It teaches us how to live together and how to live out of our heart. It teaches us how to walk with kindness and to be more gentle in our nature. Because we are, for the first time, as this Mother Earth is evolving, you see, she's in an ascension process. She's moving us all up into her heart. And that's the moment, my elders say, will be the first time human beings came. Because we haven't had the being part of ourselves here yet. We're just about to find out who we truly are.
Thank you for joining us this morning to tell us about it. It's the Traditional Storytelling Festival taking place this weekend, starting tomorrow, in West Fulton, New York, featuring the creation stories that have been passed down through generations. We've been speaking to Liv Big Tree Skywoman from Forever Farm and Joe Tima, the delegate from the Mother Earth Delegation of United Original Nations, who are putting this festival on along with The Fountain and the Center for Sacred Studies. More information about the festival at centerforsacredstudies.org. Thank you both so much for telling us about this and for letting us in on how we can make the world a little better.
Thank you for having us and for all those that are listening. Thank you for the good work you do.
Chanel and Goa for hosting us. Just wanted to share, yeah, it's an honor to host this, you know, to open it up because that's, you know, that's part of the work that we're doing at Yojijizu Forever Farm is, you know, returning to our original instructions for the Ganyakahaga, which is the people of the Flint and also the keepers of the Eastern Door. So, yeah, we hope you all join us and Yawago for hosting us and everybody have a beautiful day.
Thank you. We'll take a break. And when we come back, examining the history of herbalism, we'll be right back. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End, and you can join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I explore the deep end of the catalogs of bands maybe you know, maybe you don't know. You'll hear some Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, Government Mule, right alongside bands like The Electric Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Kula Shaker, and Supergrass. That's The Deep End each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight right here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Time in the Valleys Museum is hosting Herbal Medicine in Colonial America, a talk by Richard Mandelbaum on Sunday at the museum in Grahamsville. Registered herbalist Richard Mandelbaum of Forestburg is going to examine the history of herbalism in 18th century America, exploring some of the prominent herbal remedies using plants found locally. And joining us now to tell us a little bit more about it is herbalist Richard Mandelbaum. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Let's talk a little bit about herbs and how important they were to colonial America. In the introduction to the show, I mentioned that you know the original colonists, part of their precious cargo were those herbs. Why was it so important to them?
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Sassafras, for instance, was a huge commodity at one point from this part of the world back to Europe. But so the importance goes to many different levels, but certainly focusing on the medicinal aspects of the plants, this was medicine. You know, back then, and actually until fairly recently, 100-150 years ago. Being a physician and being an herbalist were synonyms, basically. There was no distinction between them. Just to give you an example, for instance, of something I'll get into a little bit more at Sunday's talk, and when we look into this with colonial times in the U.S., we hear some familiar names, some of the quote-unquote founding father names, but also we want to bring up into prominence some of the voices that haven't been heard as much from racial and religious minorities, women, who don't make it into the history books. But for instance, to give you an example of a name we all know, Alexander Hamilton, well, his physician, David Hossack, was present at the duel in which Alexander Hamilton was killed. David Hossack was a professor at Columbia University. He was a professor of botany and materia medica. Materia medica being the remedies used, that this is a term herbalists to this day still use, to describe the various medicines and herbal botanical remedies we have. So this was a physician. This was Alexander Hamilton's physician, and also a botanist, and herbalist. And he actually founded the first botanical garden, on an institutional level in, on the island of Manhattan at that time. So that's just one example to answer your question, but that's sort of the elite. Then there were people who were not part of that socioeconomic, gender, racial group that, for instance, he was. And this is people's medicine and always has been. And it's interesting looking back, not just at colonial times, but we could go back for thousands and thousands of years prior to that. And it's really only in the last, again, century or so that we've become divorced from that. And even many of our pharmaceuticals today, a fairly high percentage, are originally botanically derived.
Yeah, I guess when we think about medicine today, obviously it's very advanced. And when we think of herbs today, you're probably thinking of, you know, something you're putting into your cooking. But at the time, you know, medicine was very connected to these practices, indigenous beliefs, other regional, you know, factors. And medicine was developing. And so this was very ingrained in the medicine of the time.
Oh, absolutely. They were equivalent, yeah. Basically. Yes, absolutely. And you're right about cooking and food as medicine is very important, but also, and we can go around the world and certainly here in our part of the world, the wisdom gleaned and in some cases appropriated from Native American medicine is enormous. So many of the herbal remedies that are popular today, echinacea, black cohosh, et cetera, we could go on ginseng, are native to our area. And it was really thousands of years of Lenape and other Native American wisdom that lent themselves to that. So absolutely, medicine and herbalism for most of human history have been equivalent.
Can you talk a little bit more about the Lenape medicine and some of the contributions to herbal medicine?
Yeah, and that's something, too, that I'll be talking about a little bit more. One of the challenges that we have, and I would like to just share that I'm not of Native heritage at all for myself personally, but I try to approach this with the respect that it deserves. And a lot of times what can happen when we read the history books of any aspect of history, not just this one, is, you know, it's kind of the victors write the history in a sense, right? So it can become, for instance, if we're talking about the colonial period, it can become a litany of white men, many of whom are important to remember and talk about. It's not about forgetting that or pushing that to the side, but adding to that so that we're seeing the whole mosaic. And one of the interesting things with herbal history, and really, again, we're talking about the history of medicine. Those two things are synonymous for this time period. When we have to dig a little bit more deeply to find the contribution of Native American herbalism being acknowledged. But there are many examples we could give where the physicians who would write down how to use the remedies, if you pay attention to their wording very carefully, you see that they reference the fact that they studied with Native American communities to learn about the herbs, or they studied with somebody who had done that. So the names of the elders, wise women, and men who taught and shared their knowledge are mostly lost to us because of the nature of history and colonialism and et cetera. But we do see it there, that that's actually really the foundation in many ways. And it's interesting looking at this time period, because there was a great tension, which we're all familiar with in one way or another, between holding on to a European heritage and being linked as a colony to England, and the desire to become independent. And along with that, interestingly, there was a bit of a movement to pay more attention to our native plants and native herbal remedies. And again, the foundation of that wisdom all comes from Lenape medicine. But because the Lenape were, and there are still, of course, Lenape in our area, but this is a very early conquest, and people who survived being forced further west to Oklahoma, to Wisconsin, and no longer being connected to the land that they're ancestrally from. So a lot of that history you have to kind of dig between the lines. And, you know, some people listening might know the plant Joe Pieweed. Mm-hmm. And that's one example. So Joe Pieweed, which herbalists sometimes refer to as gravel root because of some of its medicinal uses. But Joe Pie, as best we can tell, was an Algonquin herbalist, an Algonquin healer. And we'll probably not ever know all the facts about his life, but we know quite a few from different accounts of the time.
And I appreciate you bringing the contribution of the Lenape to and other indigenous people to the contribution of herbal medicine and where it really all started. What you mentioned, Joe Pieweed. What were some of the other things that were very popular plant based cures at the time that we might be familiar with today?
Oh, certainly, yes. To us herbalists, I was about to mention some plants like lobelia, for instance, which some of your listeners might be familiar with, but I have to also remember that as a practicing herbalist, I can start to mention some plants that might be more obscure to other people. But even some of the herbs that we know today that are fairly popular, like echinacea, were being used, perhaps not in colonial times, but pretty soon after that, because it's more a little bit more prevalent out west. But a big one, probably the biggest one historically and to current day, would be ginseng. And American ginseng, which is Panax quinquefolius, if you go back to all accounts, it was quite prolific in our woods in eastern North America. And of course, we still have patches of it here and there in the Catskills, for instance. The Catskills is one area that was always known for its ginseng population. And it's still out there, but we need to protect it. What we need to do is start replanting it in larger amounts, because what happened since early colonial times, actually, is that Europeans arriving here realized that this plant was so closely related to the highly prized medicinal plant from Asia, the Asian ginseng, that they just started digging it up and exporting it, as you referred to earlier, as a commodity, as a way to simply make money. And there's one physician slash herbalist from the early 1800s, John Redmond Cox is his name, and he wrote about how this plant used to be so prolific in our woods and is now gone because of everybody digging it up and exporting it to Asia. So that's one that in terms of ecological restoration, really should be quite populous in our woods, and hopefully will be again one day.
And, you know, today's pharmacology and pharmaceuticals are kind of a world away from these traditional herb-based medicines. But there's a resurgence in interest there, and hence I think your talk as well. But, you know, what do you hope folks learn about herbs and how to get back to nature?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right. There is a bit of a resurgence right now in interest. And the pharmaceutical companies are actually have always kept their eye closely on herbal medicine. They don't talk about that so much publicly, but it's something like 25 to 30% of pharmaceutical drugs are originally botanically derived. So they're constantly focusing their research on the plants and the medicines that can be derived from them. But I think what you just said at the end there is highly important about connecting back to the plants themselves and to the earth, to the planets, to the ecosystems we belong to. And that's very much how I approach herbalism, and how, I don't want to speak for everybody, but how a lot of herbalists approach this is really, it's, yes, it's medicine. Yes, it's offering health support to people in various ways, right? So I work clinically with the herbs and give health consultations and so on. But in a broader sense, in a bigger picture, I think you're absolutely right. It really is about reestablishing our connection and intimacy with the natural world, which I believe is just part of biologically being a human. It's just that modern life has kind of cleaved us from that artificially.
Yeah. Well, we were kind of talking about that in our previous segment as well. And so it's good to remind folks to learn how to be a little more human and get back to where things came from and literally where we're rooted from. We've been speaking to registered herbalist Richard Mandelbaum of Forestburg. He is speaking at the Time in the Valleys Museum in Grahamsville Sunday. His talk is Herbal Medicine in Colonial America, and going to examine the history of herbalism, exploring some of the prominent herbal remedies using plants found locally, and also the contribution of Lenape medicine and its significant contribution to the herbal medicine field. Richard Mandelbaum, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And there's more information about the talk from Richard Mandelbaum on Saturday at the Time and the Valleys Museum.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this program and all of our locally produced programs at our website, wjffradio.org. Thanks for dealing with some of the technical difficulties we had earlier on, and thanks for listening. I'm Tim Bruno.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, a newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we travel to Mexico, where the country's going to elect its first female president in history before the U.S. It is the situation changing for women on the streets? We cover the International Women's Day March to find out.
For me, it's hopeful that a lot of young women are taking a part in politics.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, partly sunny, high 67, clear, low of 44 tonight. Next couple of days, sunny and pleasant, high near 70 tomorrow. Saturday's high around 75, but some showers around, not as warm Sunday, high 68. It's 11 o'clock.